which get over the last couple of slides that I didn't get to go over yesterday while we went for people to arrive. I just sort of describe what's going on here, and it'll be on the Zoom recording. We're recording. Not here, turn around. How do we translate? Is there any system? Why is the volume level? Great. So I finished, last week I was telling you the story. It's just sort of my personal lesson of how to do probing wrong. And so, the basic idea of probing was that, once you have a probe that can tell the difference between A and B, between one platform and the opposite, then you can use the accuracy of the probe to kind of guide you as an estimate for how much your representation knows the concept, right? So we did that here for Othello, but there were two different types of classifiers that we could train. One is that we train linear classifiers, but the linear classifiers were, and we trained multi-layer perceptron classifiers, like two layer, and they work right, like 98% of the time. And so we thought, well, if you can train any classifier on the thing, then that'll simply show the information that's in there. So we published it, and then I sort of told you the story that Yolanda came out a few weeks later and said, "No, this MLP, you don't need to do it. You can get the information out with a linear classifier." And so this is, I really like this chart. So this is the chart where it says, "Here's like you have white, which is a really bad guess, is like 25% wrong, and the classifier 25% wrong, and then." And then black or really dark blue here is like 0% wrong. And so our MLPs were 0% wrong, but he trained this linear classifier to do it. He trained the same linear classifier that we put in the GitHub, and it was bad. It was like 25% wrong most of the time. But then when he switched it so that the classifier predicted the things not on every turn, but on every other turn. It'd be like instead of looking at the representation on every word, look at every other word, or instead of every sentence, looking at every other sentence, or when you're studying dialogue between two people, like, oh, look at, don't look at that, every sentence, but every other sentence, like, right? You got the accuracy up to 99%. And so what's the heck? The reason was because what was trying to be represented inside the model was not. It had a representation of the Othello's word, but it was encoded in a way that we didn't expect. Instead of encoding a white square is, a white pebble is on this square and a black pebble is on another square, it was encoding a different concept, which was not the concept that we had anticipated with our training set. It was encoding, is the pebble on this square owned by the person to move or the opponent, which flips. Every other time. And so I think that there's a couple lessons from this. So one lesson is look at your data. So this is like one of the reasons that before I went into causal mediation analysis and all these other things, I was like, hey, let's just make some scatter plots to just look at some vectors and just get into the practice of doing that. I think that there's probably other ways of looking at the data too, but that's the most obvious thing to try. But if you have a way of just like looking at the raw data somehow, so Neil has like a bunch of different visualizations he was doing to try to look at the raw data, and just live with that for a while, like get a little sense for it, you might find out that you're asking the wrong question of your model, that you're not, that you have your own human bias. Or how you think the model might represent something, but the model might represent something in a slightly different way that would change what you find a lot. And so this is, I thought this was really interesting because it's a clear case where the model had an equivalent concept, but one that the classifier definition of the concept that we had was totally wrong, so wrong that, it gave us this really bad accuracy. And so, but the second takeaway besides that, which is that we were able to get the accuracy up to 98% with an MLP, which leads to this question, like, were we fooling ourselves somehow? Like, what's wrong with an MLP? And that's what the Hewitt paper is basically about. And so I just wanted to go over this. And the basic idea of the Hewitt paper is, yes.
Before we get into this new question, did he mention anything about his intuition for why did he looked into biosecure people?
I think this was the first figure where he showed it. And I think that, he was looking at, I think that he was visualizing the data in different direct ways. I don't know exactly which visualization he used. Like, in the end, he had a lot of these kind of color diagrams of what the predictions were and how accurate they were. And so he was doing, like, this, you might think of this as sort of a logit lens kind of visualization or something, a Thought board. And so I think he was just building a lot of these sort of logit lens style visualizations. And then I don't know what gave him the idea that maybe the classifier could have been made better by making the problem easier. So this is always the pattern in research, right? In research, you have something, you're trying to make it work, and you really believe in your hypothesis. You got to chase your hypothesis for a while. You think that there's got to be something here, but everything that we do to measure it is like coming up noise. And then the right reaction to that, if you unless until you stop believing your hypothesis, right? The right reaction is there a different way for me to set up an experiment? Maybe I have some confounder in there. Maybe I've got something that's making it unnecessarily hard. Maybe I've got something in there that's all noise that isn't a necessary part of the experiment that I can remove. And so I think that's what this experiment here is. It's like O'Neill says, well, maybe. For whatever reason, maybe doing this classifier in every single turn is somehow confounded, right? Maybe it'd be easier if we pick the easy turns to do. What would the easy turns be? Well, maybe the easy turns would be all the turns where the same person is moving or something, every other turn, right? And you can see how that would be like an easier problem, right? You only have to classify half of the things. And so I often will recommend this when people are doing different pieces of research things. It's like, oh, your results are really noisy. Maybe some sort of subset analysis would be useful. Maybe you don't have to, get your result to be clean on the whole data. Maybe on a subset, maybe on half the data, maybe there's a certain third of the data where your result is really clean. What is that one third? If it's systematic, then you've still learned something. Right, and that's basically what Neil did here. He says, okay, let's do it on half the data, and boom, it worked. I was not a very experienced advisor when I was working with Kenneth on this problem. Otherwise, I'm very embarrassed that we didn't do it. All I did was tell Kenneth really should be a linear classifier, right? And he tried really hard. But we didn't do something like let's do a subset analysis. Okay, so the second lesson though that comes out of it is NLPs can kind of fool you, and that's what the John Hewitt paper is about. And so I just give you a little bit of overview of what's going on here. And so the idea here is that. So this diagram here is the diagram of like, actually, I don't really even know how to understand this diagram, but it's a diagram of what a control task might be for part of speech tagging. And the basic idea is that normally to do part of speech tagging, you have to do a lot of interesting things. You might have to disambiguate ambiguous words, like I was telling you, play can sometimes be a noun, sometimes it can be a verb, it can sometimes be transitive, it can sometimes not be transitive, and whatever, right? And so to figure out like what kind of verb it is or what kind of noun it is, you sort of have to understand what's going on in the sentence. And so part of speech tagging is kind of tricky. You gotta do this thing. And so what John says is instead, what he's going to do, so he says, so if you train a classifier to classify part of speech tags out of one of these networks, you find that it has a certain accuracy. It can like get the part of speech tags out with a linear classifier at, maybe 85% or something like that, which, is okay. And then he says, but he's frustrated because a lot of people publish papers saying, oh, I can do better than the last person who wrote a probe paper saying that I can get this out at 85%. I have a new paper and I can get it out at 99%. And I've done it using a multi-layer perceptron probe, like a fancier probe, like a more complicated machine learning thing. And so now I've really proved that the information's there. It's like 99%. And John's point is that that's not really the point of it. We had a math class in here just a few minutes ago, and I feel like it's kind of like asking people, can you solve this math problem? And you give them a pencil, and then it gives you a measure of whether they can solve the math problem. And they say, yeah, they're learning something from the class. Like 80% of the people can solve the math problem. My probe has succeeded in telling me how much they know math. And then somebody else says, well, I'll really tell you whether they know math. And they distribute like pocket calculators to everybody. And they say, with pocket calculators, can you solve this math problem? And like, it's like 100%, like everybody can solve it. It's like, so now does that give you like, a better sense that everybody knows what's going on in the math? I'm not sure it does, right? And so I think that this is more or less what, John Hewitt's point of view is on the difference between a linear probe and an MLP. And the way that, he proved it was to come up with a control task baseline suggestion. And so what he says is that what MLPs are good at is they're really good at learning how to solve new problems that your neural network didn't already know how to solve. Does that make sense? Like, oh, it's like the analogy would be like not like giving calculators to everybody in class. What if you gave everybody ChatGPT in class and then you gave them the test? Right? ChatGPT is not only like good at solving the math problem, it's good at like solving new problems that you haven't seen before. And so, even if you come up with a really creative test with all sorts of new things that are getting the students to think if they're using ChatGPT, it's sort of, that test instrument that you're using might hide the signal. And so the idea here is that the control task is the new task. So you've got a task that is your regular hypothesis, like part of speech tagging, and the control task is something that would be hard to learn, but that would be kind of meaningless. And so the thing that he did here is random tagging. So he went to every single word and he gave it a random tag instead of part of speech tag. So what is this? It's like cat is normally a noun, but instead cat is part of speech 37 or something like that. I don't know. Like he didn't, he could have shuffled it and said, oh, part of speech is a verb or something like that, right? And then dog is normally a noun, but like dog and owl is like part of speech 15 or something like that. So cat and dog are like in different classes, just totally messes it all up, right? And so, if you want to solve the control task, you'd have to sort of memorize this nonsense garbage and figure out, right? That makes sense? And so the idea is if you give this special AI to the system and you ask it, can you use this AI together with your own brain to solve the part of speech task? And can you use the AI together with your own brain to solve a control task? And it gets like 100% on both of them, then that's sort of an indication that the AI is doing all the work, because we don't think that your own brain is actually doing the control task. Does that make sense? We don't think that your own brain actually represents cat totally different from dog. Like, we think that, like, it thinks both of them are nouns, kind of similar nouns. That makes sense? But the control task has some other garbage thing, which we don't think is in your head. And then, so if we give you a probing tool that measures 100% on that, it's probably not measuring what's in your head. Make sense? So that's the basic idea of the Hewitt thing. And so here's the regular probe. Then here's the control task probe. And here's what happens when you have this MLP and you make the MLP really weak. So you make it so it's barely extra layer, right? You make the extra layer like not too many neurons, right? And then here's where you make it really fat extra layer, right? You've got like a lot of extra, neurons in this extra layer, right? And when the MLP has a lot of extra neurons in the layer, you can see that it can take this garbage task and get it to near 100%. Which is meaning that the MLP is learning the new thing by itself. It's not that it was already there in the brain that you're testing. Make sense? You get it? But here, when the MLP is really weak, you can get really high. Any questions about this? Should you hear? Yes.
Yeah, the agenda is very strong, like the rising. Then we will say that if it has not a blue probe, then it's not fair.
That's right. So you would say, if it was here, you would say you're at 99%, but like for the red one, you say it's 99%, but it's not a very good probe. And so, actually, what these what so it, the logic is actually what John would say is it's this blue one, which is at 99%, which is not a good probe. So even though the blue one is measuring the thing that we really believe is in there, John would say don't believe this blue one. Because the gap to the red thing is tiny, the selectivity is low. So even though the accuracy is 99%, the selectivity is, 1 or 2%. So do you think that that's fair? Or do you think it's unfair?
I don't think there, because that means the probe, if the probe is very strong, then you always think it's not a good probe.
You think if the probe is very strong, then.
You will always think it's not a good probe because it must be like.
Well, no, like this probe, let's say this blue point was up here. Let's just say it was up there. You wouldn't say it was bad. You'd say it was good because the gap between it and the red thing is pretty large. Yes, no? That makes sense. What do you think?
Yeah, I think one way to describe it is like just because you give somebody ChatGPT and they can solve the thing doesn't mean they don't know how to solve it without chat. Like
Oh, maybe
it
it's
could very much
unfair.
it could
Oh,
very
maybe
much
it's
be
unfair.
the case that they still know how to
I see.
solve it.
I
But I think
see.
the question, I think
I see. I
that,
see.
but that what John is saying
I
is
see.
like how big of an update is it?
That's
So
right.
even though
So we can't fail you.
we can't fail you, but we can't say that you've learned it for.
That's right. That's right. That makes sense. So if we like, if you get like 100% on the test, and you by using ChatGPT. And then you can also get like 99% on a garbage test using ChatGPT. Can we fail you? And the answer you're saying is no, that's not fair. We can't fail you, right? But what we can say is it's not a very good test.
It's not a, don't have too much.
Does that make sense? That's right. Yeah, but it's not enough to fail you. It's not enough to say that you're dumb. Okay, maybe that answers your question. Okay. But it does mean, so when I say is selectivity fair? It's fair against the test is what it is. So we're backing up one level. We're not asking how good the model is. We're asking how good the test is. And it's a good way of saying it's a bad test. I'll say okay. So Guangyan had a comment. I'm not here. No. Not even online. That's it pipe up. But that's
Hello,
okay.
can you hear me?
Yes, what was your question?
Yeah, I was asking, like, why do they argue regulation to reduce generalization gap is not sufficient if your goal is selectivity?
So, is regularization enough? I think that in a sense, this plot is one of an example where it says, well, regularization is not nothing. So one form of regularization is to just reduce the parameterization, right? And you can see that it improves selectivity. There's more different types of regularization here. So here, they're doing weight decay, right? And some other things. And I guess what they're so I'd say that the conclusion from here is that regularization does help somewhat, right? When you regularize more, when you do this is sample count, reducing the steps of early stopping. You reduce the rank, reduce the number of parameters, you have higher dropout, you have higher weight decay, so all the higher regularization things are on the left. You can see selectivity generally rises when you go to the left. So the paper isn't, if you look at, I don't know about the words of the paper, but if you look at the actual results, the paper isn't totally down on regularization. It's like, okay. But then there's this other trend that he notices that's even stronger than regularization, which is the difference between the green lines and the red and the blue lines. That makes sense? And so the green lines here are all the linear models, and the red and the blue lines are all the MLPs, like the nonlinear models. And for the same amount of weight decay or dropout or early stopping or whatever, the green lines are pretty consistently like a pretty big gap in selectivity over the red and the blue models. And so that's why John Hewitt is like, I don't know about, I'm not going to recommend that people use regularization. I just recommend people use linear models, like a simpler solution, right? You'll get better selectivity. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Sure. And so now, so I think this is a little bit of the background why I kept on harping on our student kind of to try to do a linear model because of this kind of thing. Now, some people will still probe with nonlinear models because it does tell you something, but you have to watch out for this type of issue. Selectivity is related to overfitting and it's a classic machine learning problem to be aware of. So. And selectivity is, and designing a randomized control task, if you have a complicated probe, even if you have a very high dimensional linear probe, when you write your papers, if you want to get them through peer review, this is not a bad way of convincing a reviewer that your probe is a good test, right? Come up with a random control task. Say John Hewitt. Say we're going to like show the gap. We're going to measure the selectivity against this thing. You might have to put the chart in the appendix for room, but if you can show a gap like this, then you'll convince a reviewer. It's actually a good probe that you have, even if it's not linear, even if it's MLP, you could defend it this way.
If the idea is that like performance is only meaningful if it like disappears when like the meaningful structure is like destroyed, how do you like what kind of intuition do you use to identify that like meaningful structure like that we need to control out?
Oh, like what a meaning, like what a good control task is? Yeah, you asked that question.
What
Yeah.
good control?
What a good control task is?
Yeah, because I feel like the control task that they're like
Yeah.
control tasks are a function of word identity. And
Yeah.
I'm sort of like,
I'll just
then I
give every
think,
word a random part of speech.
yes. And I think that like that seems to tell you like how well can you compute random lookup tables as a function. Like I feel like how hard it is to compute a random lookup table depends on how hard it is to derive word identity and or how hard it is to determine the function that you're
Yeah.
interested in. And so I don't really know if there's an obvious
Because like when you saw his, so he had another control task for, I don't know if I have the thing, like part of speech tagging, but then also like dependency relationships in that, so which he said, oh, we'll have a weird control task, which is we'll randomly send an arc to the left or to the right in the middle or something like that, right? So, and then you look at that and you think, huh. I don't know if I would have invented that control task. It's just like some random thing, right? So like a random part of speech for every word. Yeah, sure. That like maybe, like so there's a classic experiment that machine learning people like to do, which is they like to say, how powerful is my network, my neural network, by taking classification set. Is shuffling all the labels. So you have like, a million images and some of them are dogs and some of them are cats and some of them are sailboats and some of them are trucks and whatever, right? And then what you do is you just take exactly the same data set and you just completely scramble all the labels and then you train your model on it to see what accuracy it gets on that. It's exactly the same as this experiment here, but it's like the, but what they call that is they call that the memorization baseline. Right, so there's these two things that you can have a model do. Machine learning people like to say that you can have a model generalize or memorize. And so when a model generalizes, it's supposed to be finding regular patterns in the data. And after it sees a few of the same regular patterns, then even if you show it a new example of a new sailboat that it's never seen before, a new cat that it's never seen before, because it recognized the patterns for a sailboat. Or a cat, right? It can guess the new one, right? But the other thing that network can do is just memorize. It can remember that I saw exactly this cat before, and this cat is A, and I saw this other cat is class B, and this sailboat here is class A, and this a different sailboat is like class B, and it's just like, they're just all scrambled. Some sailboats are A, and some sailboats are B, and some cats are A, and some cats are B, and they don't look anything like each other. But if you have a powerful neural network, it can remember that anyway after you train it for a while. But it won't do what we call generalization. If you show it a new cat, then it will have no idea. Give it a random label, because it has no idea what random means. Does that make sense? So that a classic control task is just shuffle the labels. So, like, if you needed to come up with a control task, then the natural thing to do would be to just say, well, just like Hewitt, we're going to shuffle the labels. We have stripy things and not stripy things, and we'll have a control task, and we'll just like randomly assign stripy things to not stripy or something like that. And we'll see how well that program does that. But Hewitt's like, well, sometimes that's too hard. And like if you really shuffle every single thing, it might be too hard. So you might want to arrange things in groups and then shuffle the groups or something like that to make it a little easier. And the reason is because he's looking for this gap. And if you make the control task too hard, then the control task can, sit down there at low accuracy, even though, he's arguing that what you want to do is you want to find that there's a meaningless task that it could have learned. Instead, so so this is a hole. It's a kind of a hole in his analysis. If you need to come up with a good control task that reveals the weakness of your test, make sense? Yeah, it's like I think that after spring break, I'm supposed to have a professor come here and watch me teach, and so they're gonna. See if there's a hole in the way that I teach. Something that I'm doing that doesn't convey to you guys the actual knowledge, but just makes you feel like you have the illusion of getting knowledge or something like that. But what's the test, right? Well, you could devise a test and it passes it with flying colors, but maybe with a more stringent test, you could say, oh, there's a gap here, there's a selectivity problem. But there's an art to coming up with. So then the last thing I wanted to talk about probing was other things that you can do for probing. There were a bunch of questions about from Ayush and Eunice about probing ideology and personality and biases and things like this. And so I just want to point out that there's been a bunch of work doing probing for interesting things. There's this nice work from Yida Chen over at Harvard that builds probes that look into LLMs that tell you, like, does the LLM think that you are a certain age, a certain gender, a social, certain socioeconomic status, certain education. And what these classifiers are is they're basically probes. I think they just trained a bunch of linear probes on a bunch of text that came from young people, that came from men and women, that came from whatever, right? And they said, how accurate is the model at, classifying this information? And they took their high accuracy probes and they hooked them up to a user interface. So you can probe for things like beauty, you can probe for things like socioeconomic status, and and it often works pretty well. Okay. That's all I wanted to talk about for probes. Now let's go on to the presentations. Any other questions about probes before we move on? Any probing questions? Meanwhile, we have Team TK up here. Really any questions I have to answer, any questions about probes? Yes.
Could you probe a probe?
Can you probe probes?
Yeah, like if you had an NLP probe, could you have applied a linear probe on that to see if it.
Yeah. In a sense, in a sense, that's what we're doing. We're doing this weird thing, right? Because our neural networks are already machine learned models. They're already fake ones. And then it's like, why are we taking these fake models and then putting other fake models on top of them? And it's this weird exercise. So you can probe a probe. That's actually all that we're doing. Like the LLM itself is a probe, for text. The probe for text is like tells you what the next word is, and we're probing little pieces of it. I think the way to think of a probe is like, so is there have people probed probes? Oh no, I don't know if people have done that. Yes,
I think there was like some stuff where they tried to decompose probes into SAE features, so they did some kind of weird
really? There was a
attribution
paper.
thing, and then yeah, I think they
All right.
did some stuff, but
All right.
I don't know.
Ask Grace. Grace will tell you on Discord if people have probe probes. Grace is our lab's probing expert, so I'm a little embarrassed.
Great
Like,
last name for that.
I know it's
yes. Lecturing about probes right in front of Grace here. So, yes, good question though. All right, Team TK. You guys ready?
Yeah, I have some slides to represent. I'm not, I like kind of, yeah. It's not just on probes.
Oh yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. You guys are now into the, I think that you have enough methods that you can just do whatever.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Because I like kind of restructured the task a little bit and so okay, I'll just start from here.
You want to push the next time? Okay.
Right, cool. So I basically we're the ones that are trying to better understand if there's some sort of like speaker role representation.
So that I have time. Sorry.
Get it. How much time do I get?
I don't think 10 minutes. Okay. Well, 10 minutes for me. 10 minutes shifting really fast.
Okay, yeah. So basically, we want to know if there's role representations in dialogues when you give an LLM a transcript that has not already been differentiated. And so this kind of comes into role entity a little bit, but the question is, do LLMs encode with speaking as some sort of structured signal? There's a theory linked to this back in, from 1990 in Smolensky's work, where he looks at tensor product representations as like roles and fillers. And so in a transcript, the role would be speaker one, speaker two, or something, and then the filler would be like Alice Bob. So the LLM needs to like bind speaker one to Alice and speaker two to Bob, and then whatever Alice says later on has to get bound to rule one. Whatever Bob says later on has to get bound to rule two. That's like a very theoretical framework that Smolensky created, and his whole take on that is that it should be decomposable through linear operations, right? And so then there is this like empirical link from more recent times about how do language models bind entities in context to show models can track entity role assignments. So that's basically what we're trying to explore. So I got Claude to give me 20 different dialogues between two speakers, Alice and Bob. And they have 80 turns each, turn meaning like the text that Alice said is one turn, the text that Bob says is another turn. Then I did some length control so it didn't get too crazy. And I like the speaker swap stuff, ignore it for now because I thought it would be a good control, but it's probably, now that I think more about it, I don't think it is. But yeah, so basically this is just a screenshot of what I have. Like there's six different topics, Alice and Bob like have some sort of like conversation or dialogue or debate on these things. Okay. So I'm looking at residual stream activations. I'm only extracting from layer 20 right now. I will eventually scale up to other layers. So basically for each turn of the dialogue, this is a typo here. It's not the full dialogue, but turn. It's like the dialogue up until the current turn gets fed into the model, which is like as a text string. So it's been concatenated. And then the context is the only tokens that it gets tokenized after the forward pass and the hidden states are captured. We're only looking at the tokens of that current turn text here. We're not looking at anything else. And then, so these are averaged into a single vector per turn. Now, because of the results I'm going to show, I'm actually going to change this a little bit too. I don't want to average it anymore because I think it might diffuse a signal. I'm going to look at the last token of each turn moving forward. But I just wanted to say like for this one, it's averaged. Okay, so the first thing we did is for all the dialogues together, do a PCA and try to see if you can tell if there are separable clusters. Not really, as you can see. So that's the big takeaway. It's like, and here you're just seeing the swapped label condition just overlap with what it should overlap with. So Bob swapped, Alice base, Bob base, Alice swapped. Okay, so then I was like, okay, well, let me see what one dialogue looks like in this global PCA space to see if that's like a little bit more separable. And it seems like maybe, maybe not. Like I could probably draw a line right here. Something else that's really interesting about this is that, so each of these dots are turns, right? Down here, this is like turn zero, and then this is turn one, and this is turn two. And so when we get up here, this is the later turns. I thought that was cool. I don't know what to make of it, but I don't know.
It's cool.
And so now that I see this, I looked at a couple different like dialogues like this and saw by eye, I feel like I could probably draw a line. That was like pretty good. So I was like, why don't I look at this per transcript then? So within transcript, we're looking at the role axis over time. So is there a stable role axis within this dialogue? So what we're doing is we basically have these two clusters, right? And so I want to find the centroid of the Bob cluster and the Alice cluster. And then I want to find the midpoint between those two clusters. And so the idea is that we're going to give it a score, like for each turn gets a score, where we take the turn, which is x sub t, minus the midpoint, and then take the dot product of that with the roll direction vector, which is just the centroid of Alice minus Bob in this case. And so that's what I'm kind of showing, like plotting here. And you can see now, clearly, there is some separability here, right? And so everything that's blue is Alice, everything that's orange is Bob. So I'm basically just projecting each turn onto this like vector, roll direction vectors. And here I just highlighted where this model messed this up. And like, I pulled out the actual like text to see why. They are not like, they don't have great personalities. It's all very neutral. So it's like nothing obvious jumped out to me, the human, about why the model miscategorized these.
Can you make the screen big? What is the text?
How do I?
Just press slideshow, the little white button in the upper, yeah. And so which line of text was the one that was?
So this is Alice, the blue dot, which is crossed over into the wrong region. This is Bob, Alice again, and then Bob. and they're talking about how cities should be structured. So I actually pulled out a couple different projections like this for the dialogues, and some of them were messier than others, but generally speaking, the majority did separate them. So I wanted to like figure out a better way to kind of like define that. And so now what we're doing is taking this like role direction vector per transcript, and then we're looking at the cosine similarity. And so obviously on the diagonal, they're gonna be perfectly similar. That's good, so it worked. And then off diagonal, you see a lot of red, some gray, some blue. So basically the red is gray because it's sort of pointing in the same direction, or at least it's the same sign. Gray means that they're completely orthogonal. And then blue means it's pointing in the opposite direction, basically. So it's like not super great. So there's something I think, this is where I'm like, okay, I messed this up somehow because I think there's a confound in the transcripts themselves, which is what's maybe actually getting picked up, not the role direction vectors themselves. So it could be like the stances that each Bob and Alice take. It could be like one of them is arguing pro something, the other is saying no, con. That might be actually what we're looking at as opposed to speakers. Okay, and then, so this is, just to summarize it all together, we're looking at distance over dispersion versus silhouette. And so distance versus dispersion is kind of going back to what I talked about earlier. We're just looking at the between centroid distance between the two clusters. And then clusters can be different because they might be dense and like pulled in together. They might be really like scattered. That plays a role in separability. And so we like created the separation score using between centroid and within cluster dispersion. And so what this says is how far apart are the centroids relative to the spread of each of those clusters. And silhouette, I just use this from scikit-learn. It's how close are the points to its own cluster versus the other. And so on the y-axis, you're seeing silhouette, x-axis, you're seeing distance over dispersion. And so basically like the more separable they are, the more within one cluster. Okay, and then I kind of like tried to take some inspiration from this like concept of function vectors. So I wanted to see if across dialogues, if we could learn a single role detection vector from training data and then classify held out turns to and use the sign of the projection on that direction. And so I compared it against some baselines like label shuffling, and then I also tried just random directions. So it's barely like above chance in terms of role direction, and label shuffle and random directions are at chance as they should be. And again, this is a cross dialogue. So this is where I was like, okay, I need to try to look at it per transcript. So then I had to split the transcripts turns themselves into train tests. So it learns transcript specific direction and then on the training turns, and then we evaluate it on the held out turns. Here, again, you see this like distribution where it does get pretty good for many of the transcripts, in fact, but there are some that are below chance or around chance. So this might also have to just do with the dialogue, the topic, how exactly Alice and Bob are speaking to each other, things like that. Okay, the linear probe experiment, I don't know if I did it perfectly great, but I trained this directly on the averaged vectors from the residual stream activations then. So I used it to try to predict role, which is what we care about, speaker A versus B, variant, which is the original dialogue or speaker swapped, and then topic, because I had this like nagging feeling that topic was the issue here. And so as you can see, the linear probe seems to have better accuracy when it comes to topic, baseline basically for variant and role, so.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I tried it per transcript for role decodability, and you can see it's just above chance, not that much higher. Yes, nailed it. That was the last slide.
Great. Nice experiment. Nice negative result. And so you can see the value probes. It's like, oh, yeah, my probe can learn this. Yeah, thing. I didn't want to learn this. Perfect.
Yeah. So I'm going to try this again on the last token, just to see if it like kind of gives a clearer signal or something.
Cool.
It's one question. I maybe missed this part, but in the part where you calculated the vector, are you explicitly like, have you given Alice and that speech to the vector, or is it just the speech?
Which vector? This
the one before this. The when you're doing the one before this.
Yeah, this one, the mm-hmm. role direction vector. So when you're calculating U of A, that's, I'm assuming that's Alice.
Yeah. So is the model, does the model have access to the fact that Alice did speak this, or does the model like just have access to the text? So is it Alice is to
This is not the model. It's just like I'm just taking all the vectors and taking the mean of the vector and then taking the mean of this is like this is just kind of geometry. It's like there's no model here doing anything.
No, like how do you get the vector?
The vector is like so I have the all of the turn vectors, right? And so like there's a bunch of turn vectors for Alice, there's a bunch of turn vectors for Bob, and I just take the average for Alice.
Does the turn vector have Alice written in the
Oh, so you're saying the label is completely separate. It's like the model doesn't see it, the like Sorry, I thought you meant like the models I used to for that.
Do you think that might be too much of an implicit signal? I don't know, because the text that the Alice is speaking may not, when you're deriving the vector, may not be like related to what Alice's persona.
Yeah, most likely. I mean, the model, when you give an LLM a transcript, it is able to be like, oh, there's two speakers here, right? Like if you use like as Jasmine's shown so many examples, like. So how, like, the whole point here is, like, how does this figure it out? Is it really contextual? It just, like, finds people with, like, two different opinions, and it's, like, that can't be the same person, or it's one person with a split personality. Like, you know what I mean? Like, how does it determine this exactly? It's kind of, like, how we're trying to hack it.
It was nice that you saw the separation for a single transcript.
Yeah,
and I guess I was surprised at how many dots you got. You actually, it looks like your transcripts are pretty long, like a single one.
Yeah, 80
credits. And so, are they long enough that you can have a holdout, so you could like drop out a bunch of things and then test on the holdout?
Yeah. I think so. I can make them longer too, but I think 80 is quite a lot. And plus, like I have 20 different dialogues, so I can just I've been able to repeat it and look at the standard deviation.
I see.
Yeah.
I think I drop them in, like give them personas. They're like more distinct to. If we have a work,
like the personalities,
yeah,
one like maybe goofy or fun, like, or this kind of goes to the power group, like having one be an advisor versus student role, like that kind of thing would probably, but then it's like we're getting away from like how do you disambiguate role from like the character that's played by the role. The other thing I wanted to try for an experiment here is that both Alice and Bob have two different stances in the conversations. I want them to agree by the end. So, like, I'm going to tell the LLM, like, starting turn 50, start making them see each other's side and come to an agreement. Because then I want to see this plot again and see if it completely collapses at that point. Is, like, the next, like, thing to kind of test that.
There's also a good setting for that control task idea from John. Right?
Yeah.
Like, if you took the same transcripts and you shuffled Alice and Bob somehow. Would it make it harder for you to figure out what's going on?
Yeah, that's
or
true.
Or be able to do this anyway.
So instead of a speaker swap, just like random.
If you just randomly said half of these things were Alice, half of these things were Bob.
Yeah.
Just shuffled.
Yeah,
but linear probes can be pretty powerful too. So like, you know, I wonder if we could use separation. Yeah. Oh, then it would be like, oh, this is not so cool after all.
Well, depends on everything else also.
but it's interesting to me. Okay. Click on the next team so we know who it is. Who's representing Team Excellent today? I like the choice that you guys made of picking a presenter. That's not a bad way to do it. But you can just like choose a different victim every week.
Oh, we all have very
super stuff.
So last week what did we do? So basically last week we are trying to separate the label from ternary and binary. Binary is like a without uncertainty. The ternary is like low, medium, and no intermediate and high uncertainty. And this is the result we get. As you can see here, first of all, the binary ASR accuracy is much higher rather than ternary result here. It's here. So. But surprisingly, even if we give the definition and the label meaning, it doesn't really mean that the model can make the agreement. Actually, you can see here, given the definition and label actually makes the accuracy lowest.
Oh, really?
Yeah, among all the for the trend risk settings. So the top one is the without definition and without labeling. This is the only give definition of the uncertainty. This is only give the definition of different labels. This is without given everything. While this is lowest among all the three models.
And that's accuracy with respect to human labels. Is that
Yes.
right?
This is not too much. We only have like 70 labels.
Sure.
Yeah, we only consider these. But there's a very interesting like decision boundary shift. If you're given the definition between no and intermediate uncertainty. But there is no, basically no from high to no uncertainty confidence. They're not very common.
Plus, because our data is too complicated, so we are creating synthetic data to see whether a learning model can do uncertainty. And we still have three kinds of data. One is numerical data, which means there is numbers in the statement. For example, we have low uncertainty to high uncertainty. Yeah, and here is the result because the poor label is too complicated, so we do two labels.
So can you so before you show the data, can you describe the experiment in a little bit more detail? So what did you do with the text and what are you reading? What did you read it to? What's inputs and outputs?
Inputs is a statement, and
So literally these four statements, no, you must have more than just these four statements. Is that right?
yeah, of course, we have hundreds of statements.
And how did you generate them?
Not and
It's okay. That's cool. That's all that. I'm just trying to understand what it is that you did.
We made a lot of effort because learning models always generate with a template and it makes many syntax symbols on the different labels. So we generated a lot of them and chose some.
Try to choose ones with diverse syntax.
Yeah.
I see.
So right now it's a little hard-coded, but like we might try API later. Basically, Shuli did was she sort of like created different levels of synthetic data where like this one is the like probably the easiest where you have like mean and variance mathematically, and we also have like economic synthetic data that are like a little more complicated, less complicated than the earnings calls.
Nice.
And yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So you don't have to. So actually, one of the things I feel like is you get into this, getting towards making the peer reviewed paper, you realize that, oh, actually data preparation, like the whole story that you have about like how you synthesize your data sets, that's like an interesting story in itself, right? That's like an interesting part of the research and stuff. Okay. Feel free to, talk about, all the dilemmas you face with that in the future. So, okay, what did you get?
Here the PC from layer 0 to 7, and we can see that in the first layer it has some island, and then it became clusters. And in the middle layers, it became very separate. It's a mean pool. The previous one was the last token, and in the mean pool, the layer 0 is already separate. But not island. And the second category of the data is equal data. There's no numbers in the statement.
No numbers.
No numbers. So basically, you have like those are also a little bit templated. So like for no uncertainty, there are like things like immutable schedules, like a bunch of it. But for high uncertainty, you have like a lot of different directions, moving pieces, a lot of things going on.
I see.
And I guess this data is like more realistic. So we before like doing PCA stuff, like we tried model performance on this, and like we basically gave like two shot prompts to it, and then see like whether it gives the correct label for the so like in this test we only extract the no uncertainty and high uncertainty ones to like just be binary, and like we also try like feeding in the definitions just like what Lucia has did, And it seems like the model is leaning towards like giving uncertain answers even on the samples without uncertainty. So, and also like a similar trend observed is that when you give definitions, it's not necessarily improving the performance. So like the definition one is exactly the same as the one Lusa used. But like the second one, because the definition one didn't work, so I tried like looking into the data set and like make a much precise, a little bit data set specific definition, which definitely makes it like better.
Oh no.
But I don't know, like this definition might not be realistic given that we have like we're looking at our cost. But given those, even though like it's bad at those without uncertainty, we still feel like at least it is like separating things. Like for example, on the on those certain samples, it's like half half, but like on the uncertain samples, it predicts like 100% of the time. So we try like a little bit of activation patching, where our question is like which layer encodes information regarding a statement's uncertainty level. And for this, we did not do like token level patching because like at the end of the day, uncertainty concepts would be dispersed across the entire earnings calls. So we do not really care about like, oh, which token encodes that information, but rather we sort of like ask which well, like in this experiment, for example, we basically patch at the end of sentence period for the statement. And so we construct like contrastive pairs. So like for each sample, we have like a corresponding contrast sample that talks about the same thing, for example, GPT growth, a GDP growth, sorry. But like with the uncertainty label flipped. And we ran this across like 100 contrastive pairs. And it seems like the so you can see like the clean baseline is the ones with uncertainty. So like this is like basically the logit difference between yes and no, and it's like very high. But like for the corrupted baseline, it's like the logit difference between yes and no on the certain samples. Similar to like our model performance results, it is like near zero because it is like half percent of the time it also outputs like yes when the sample has no uncertainty. So like it sort of corresponds to our empirical testing. But basically the takeaway is that at layer 12-ish, patching in the clean sample's token activation at the period token helps recover like about half of the logit difference. So we do think that this is like a strong evidence that uncertainty concept is like present here, I guess.
And here is the PCA result. And then we can see that in the layer zero, it's separate, but not that separate. But in the next layers, it's becoming very separate. Next, please. And in the middle layer, they're all very separate. And next, next. And in the last, it became mixed again. Yeah, it's very expected. And it's the full label PCA. And in the
We'll skip to the next
Oh, 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 we also want to see that whether learning model can tell value from risk. So we do also what is that experiment? Okay, oh, we did an experiment to see to decouple this, and it's the result we can see that in layer 20 and layer 24, it's almost 90 degree.
So for this one, basically, we were talking about like the first and second moment separation of concepts. The second moment is like the uncertainty, which is the variance. The first moment is like how bad things are, which is like sentiment, basically. And we want to see if the model sort of like understands, oh, the market is bad doesn't mean the market is uncertain. Like, so like we try sort of like getting the direction of uncertainty versus the direction of sentiments and see like calculating the correlation, cosine similarity between those. And this is on the toy data set. So I guess like one direction for our research project would be like going further. Like I think this direction of separating the two like uncertainty direction and the like first moment and second moment directions is really interesting. And so we had like localized sort of like localized the uncertainty concept using this synthetic data. We might want to make it better, make it less templated, and then actually recover this uncertainty direction and do the same thing on the sentiment direction, or like the first moment direction,
and then see like if we could do some causal intervention and see like are the model using them separately, independently.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff. Any suggestions for this team?
Can we see the activation of patching this light report, the contrast of pairs?
You want to see the data sample for it?
Yeah,
Oh, okay. So while you're looking at that, one of the questions that I have about this is, when you have all this synthetic data, you wonder with these small data sets, actually even with the natural data, are you basically getting unigram detectors? Are you just like detecting a vocabulary shift? And I wonder if it's possible to do something to generate text that has the same vocabulary with words in different order, that convey a different, it's a little bit of one of these crossword puzzle problems, right? Is there some way of constructing different sentences that have very different uncertainties within the same words?
See. Okay. So the answer would be if the model gives like performs differently, then
Yeah,
my understanding
it's
would
a
be
little
off.
suspicious, like when you have the PCA separation, and even at layer zero,
Yeah,
right?
that's awesome.
It's like pretty separated.
It's a problem of data generating that if we created with same words, that means that there's only a little words that will tell the difference of uncertainty.
Yeah.
And maybe model will easily separate
You
them.
could easily separate it.
Yeah.
Yes. And you just in your PCA, you're just getting
Yeah.
the separation between has these words and doesn't have these words.
Exactly.
Yeah. What were you thinking about this contrasted pair?
Cool. Yeah, our contrastive pairs are I guess I've been thinking about more similar pairs. But then my problem with that was, are we just picking up the difference between the words that we have changed
Right.
or the concept?
Right. Yeah,
I thought
that's
this
tricky,
thing
yes.
better
You like this
somehow.
better?
Yeah.
You like this better?
Well,
Yeah.
we lose the precision on the token position level because this is like more abstract and like it's like they looks different, but because I guess our belief is that you couldn't expect uncertainty to be located like on like a word level, which is exactly why we're looking at it. Like we wanted to.
Maybe a dumb question, but like I think one of you works with Baker from Baker, Blum, and Davis. Isn't EPU like literally they just look for words though? Like they're looking for words like tariffs or like
Yeah, you mean like the models? Wait,
they don't, I don't even
not
know like what
LLMs.
their model is. They just have like a list of words. So like I was just because you said that like it's not like uncertainty isn't being expressed at the word level, but like when I read through transcripts like for earnings calls, it's usually just like they're talking about like tariffs or something, and there's like a pretty major benchmark like the policy uncertainty index, and I think they also just look at words.
I guess the motivation Veronica originally had was that like yeah, people has been looking at like words, back of words, style models, but they're also like trying to use LLMs to gen and see like if they are better, and I think they are. There are some like, for example, one paper used LLMs to like generate the EPU measure, and then like that like on a scale of 0 to 10, something like that, and like that correlates with economic outcomes. And like sort of like the point is to see like oh why LLMs can't understand those. If the conclusion is it is on the word level, that's like a failure, but like
If you could have just come up with a bag of words model to equivalent, then it's kind of disappointing. That's what you're saying.
yeah.
Yeah. You had these different types of. I still like this question of are different types of uncertainty the same? and you have different data sets. You've got your number experiments, where I can totally imagine number experiments having balanced tokens, where you know you switch the number, the roles of the numbers around, or something like that in some way in a sentence, and it changes. You know, the probability is a lot while it's just the same numbers, and I can totally imagine that the models are pretty good at understanding number sentences. And then for these other sentences, you know, I do buy it that there's some words that just are inherently about uncertainty, like the word uncertain. You know, maybe you just say the word and it's uncertain. And so the thing I wonder is, when you have like unigram uncertainty, when you have like an utterance or something like talks about uncertainty as just an abstract concept, and you have uncertainty that shows up because of a situation, maybe because you have certain bets or something like that. Is that the same thing to the model? Right? Like I'm kind of interested in, as a reader, I'm like interested in whether these two worlds are the same inside the LLM, right? Like the old backwards thing that the economists were doing, just looking for words. You know, does the LLM, when the LLM sees a word, does it have an internal reaction that it's the same as when it sees like, you know, a certain set of cards on the table, something like that? It's like, oh, you know, now I have no idea whether I should bet one way or the other because there's a lot of uncertainty for this poker hand. You know, without having to say the word uncertain. You know, yeah. So like, is that or are those totally different concepts?
Yeah. We do need to poke around the data. Like for example, shuffling.
Yeah, like what would it do? It would if you found ways of patching across very different domains, if you patch from the number domain to the word domain or from the word domain to the number domain or something like that, and you know, you could have the same effects, that might make sense. So you patch a little bit, you have some effects, but sort of in domain or not. Maybe across domain patch is worth playing with. I don't know, it's just a crazy idea. Anything else this would you suggest for this project?
I was going to suggest to our group, but like one of the easiest things we can do is like switch numbers around, which is like if like have one number that's like we expect 0.1% variance in like 20% growth, and it's like 20% variance
0.1%. Yeah. Yeah, and it's the same numbers, but you know, play different roles. Yeah. That's cool. So, yeah, you're seeing separation. You're seeing sort of causal effects, but you're all looking like, oh, so do we have something yet? And it doesn't feel like you have something yet, right?
Yeah.
Right. So you have these questions about layer zero is finding, so there's all these confounders, right? And then even if you do get clear separation, you're not sure that it's surprising that you know that the models can classify. So you look inside, you can classify, what's the big deal, right? So I think that it's, but maybe the questions are, that are interesting are these kinds of things like, I guess like what you asked, like what is the model using to classify it? Does it need the words? Be able to tell what's going on with uncertainty. If you take away the words, does it still work? Like is it the same concept as you had very balanced numbers, things like that? It's another way of saying, you know, it doesn't need the words. If the words are present, it'll use them. But I hate to think about it some other way. Yeah, I'm not sure. What would you have to do to nail down that story?
If we could have like a data set that is
like not having the bag of words, but like are uncertain, like we know that that would be great.
Oh, that you just say blacklist the whole word. So you have the standard economic model. Then you tell your LLM, make a lot of uncertain text that violates this model. Tell the LLM, your mission is to come up with sentences that score badly on this. But actually are the other way. And then you can look inside those. Yeah, maybe something like that. That's cool. That would be a cool thing to say.
What do you know what like some of the transcripts look like where like a model labels it as uncertain but it doesn't like contain any of the words? Did you like I was wondering if you guys had looked at like basically transcripts that get labeled as uncertain by like an LLM but don't contain like any of the like bags of like the words in the their like EPU's bag of words. Like, it's just that's really interesting that it can
be better. I think there are few because in reality we're doing a landing call, you like the one who speak don't want others to know they're uncertain about their financial like conditions. So they're when they're talking, they're actually hiding.
Mm-hmm.
I would say so. In many cases, the like I'm not quite sure of all other like uncertain. These words were not directly showing in the conversation.
But the LLM knows.
Yeah. I would say there are directly knows. There are, like, as you can see the result, there are, like, nearly 50% of the disagreement on different level of uncertainty based on different models. So I would say models are quite, not very quite sure about the uncertainty.
Oh, when the words aren't present?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. But in aggregate, like, it outperforms EPU on predicting, like, different economic...
But that question, like, one, we haven't tried like larger models, so we are not quite sure whether the model's parameters will affect, like, given a more frontier models will give better result. But as far as we have, it's not works good.
What's that model you're using?
Gemma 2 9B, Llama 8B, and Qwen 7B is like rather small. All less than 10 billion.
Yeah. So I've been very happy with the capability. So the next size up, like 30 billion, like Qwen 30B, you know, Llama 70B. Like I've been pretty happy that they, you know, can do pretty good linguistic understanding. They have pretty good theory of mind. They have good other things. Whereas when you get down to 70 models, like they're pretty grammatical. They understand a lot of things about the world, but they're very simplistic, right? It's like talking to a little kid.
Yeah.
And they don't have good theory of mind. Yeah. So like if you think about that as a milestone, right? Like the difference between a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old is, you know, like a 5-year-old will be able to second guess you, be able to, you know, play a theory of mind game with you, and a 4-year-old we'll just believe everything that you say. Everything's just surface level. There's nothing under the surface. And maybe if you look at these small models and can't do theory of mind, that's like the mindset you're kind of like, you're sort of asking a 4-year-old to read the earnings calls. That makes sense.
Yeah.
If you use Open Router, it's good for testing them out before you go like all in and you're like, I'm going to collect activations.
Oh, I forgot to mention to everybody. Oh, we have, there's a budget for some compute that Aruna has raised, like thousands of dollars for you guys to just spend. So she's gotten a credit card that we can reimburse and got accounts. And all you have to do is go on the Discord or, you know, find the email or whatever. It's so there's a run pod thing for running, you know, detailed experiments. So if you want to like set up some training runs or something like that, it's convenient to do other ways, you can use this run pod thing. And apparently, the invitation expires this week.
Today.
So is it expires today?
Yeah.
It expires today. Not even tomorrow?
No.
Okay. So don't forget, before you go eat your dinner, right? Go get like this free account thing. And yes, if you miss it, of course, we can go back to it and say, oh, sorry, I missed it. But yes, go get the free thing.
It's $1,500 right now.
Yes.
I was wondering if it's like the teens 1500 or is it?
I think it's the class.
It's just a whole class. So yeah, so use it fast before it's all gone. No, it'll be fine. I think that we can refill it, stuff like that. It'll be fine. Yeah,
I think it's
okay.
Today.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot, you guys. Yeah, who's next? Is Team Spatial the team that wants to go next week, or is it this one? Okay, I have both.
I think he went to the washroom.
Oh, Team Spatial is in the washroom.
I don't know if people are there on the Zoom.
Anybody on Zoom?
Maybe can we go to
it's
the
next team? We can connect for them. Anybody on the team that wants to present today?
Oh, that's a bad thing.
Oh.
Oh.
Okay, we'll come back to the spatial. Who's next?
Next class, but then.
Okay, but you want to skip.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll go to the next. We'll come back to team spatial when washroom time's over. So here, next one here.
Team power.
Cool name. Well, okay, we have some patching experiments to report on and some data set construction kind of next step stuff to report on. So we'll try to go quick. The first is, so this is like the setup that we've been playing around with. This is like the prompt in the following sentence: does entity exercise power over someone or something else, true or false? Then insert the sentence, what's the answer? We've been trying to shorten this a little bit and then playing around with true or false, yes, no, but this is what we're gonna be doing, this setup. So like this is an example sentence, right? Tony reassigned them to the basement office, or they reassigned Tony to the basement office. And we've been playing around with hatching. So this is what that sentence looks like. And we get a lot of like clear signal down here at the period and then at the colon in terms of flipping the outcome from true to false. And then it's a little bit kind of a little bit more undecipherable in here. This is the they token, so going from they to Tony, and then Tony to they. And they actually move bumps it in the opposite direction. So it makes it more likely to be false when you kind of patch there. So I think we're
It's weird. So it goes the opposite.
Yeah. But I think because we're like switching the position of the people, right? So the Tony, when Tony gets patched down, now there's two Tonys in the sentence.
So you think this is a pointer effect when you're like mixing up the pointers is the thing, as opposed to mixing up the power structure.
Yeah, that might, yeah, that there's something going on about, yeah. But yeah, we don't have like a very clear articulation of that. And then we flip it the prompt around. And so it's something or someone exercising power over Tony. We get somewhat similar structure. It's a less pronounced on the first token here, but as a Tony token, there is a big shift. And then, so within this setup, we've been trying to figure out if there's other ways to kind of get a power beyond just kind of flipping the order of the entities. So Armida's been thinking very carefully about this. Hand it over to you.
This is another setup data that we switch a verb, see how it impacts the output. And we can see that. when fire is changed to greeted, then there is some something going on here where also these two positions. But I'm still thinking that is the if we change the like prompt to the to other things like not exercising power, but something that asks about the characteristic which true and false means something for it, then I still expect to see this here, see the same like pattern result.
Even if it has nothing to do with power.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And still thinking how we can like pick the power from this.
Right.
What do you have an interpretation of what this means? Like it's switching from true to false at that word. Is that it?
Well, some the dynamic of the power is very related to the verb. Like firing or doing something forceful.
Like, there's a lot of semantic meaning in the verb. Okay, we're trying.
One interesting experiment would be if you make it a third person sentence. Like, you flip the sentence around and switch the position of the verb and see that, like, instead of just switching the verb, also switching the position of the verb and see if this moves to that position. Like, the employee was greeted by Sean.
The combination of this one and the previous one.
Yeah, just to confirm that it is the verb. And it stores the relationship between. I'm just thinking, like, if it's a position thing or a verb thing.
Yeah, if it's because we're asking about Sean, and then this is the word that comes after it, as opposed to, like, switching this into the passive voice.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, there are other prompts that can make difference in the outcome, like do you exercise power or do you hold power? Does this person hold power over someone or somebody? So for the sentences that the power is not much clear for them, it can make a difference.
Yeah, and remember, like, I think where we kind of started with this was kind of, like, how much do we impose a definition of power? And, like, I think one thing that we're kind of struggling with that is that maybe we're shading into all of these different kind of conceptions of power, that we're kind of bumping into different concepts within the model. And, like, so, yeah, I think we're in this place where there's, like, a little bit of a give and take between, like, having a kind of clear conception of power versus kind of trying to figure out what is the breadth of this within the model. Yeah.
You.
Oh no, I put a bunch of other stuff in here, but this is you. Yeah.
Okay. So, coming along to there. So looking at these examples, we can see that in some cases as well from experience in the previous weeks that there are limitations to even the instruct models versions. Conditions of power, for instance, they're bad at false negatives. There are certain contexts where it's less confident if you have multiple modifiers, right? So as we get into different definitions of power, one thought was that one thing we advanced on was trying to systematically expand our synthetic data set. So that's one thing here. So now we're cross-referencing about 200 granular power mechanisms and different entity based conditions. So we want to try to. So for instance, like we start with like, I think 11 or 12 hard categories: economic power, military power, digital power, etc. Right. But and then from there we articulate different contexts. So this might, in the case of military power, that might be embargoes. Defining legitimacy, strategic weapons, etc. So that results in about 220 different contexts around here with different actor attributes, because we want to be able to try and isolate for different things. So for instance, there might be contexts where power is loaded. So in the use military example, you might have an instance where it's like, oh, the commanding officer decided something, right? As opposed to the subordinate decides, right? There are modifiers, might be based on gender, rank, and other descriptors that might encode notions of power. So to really kind of stress test that spectrum, like the landscape of it,
We're trying to expand the synthetic data set to account for these things. As you said, we're doing a full matrix cross-referencing, so it's about 3,000 records for positive, and I'm constructing one for negative. We'll get into that next. One other thing is that, as we said, we want to be able to try and scan for if it's verbs, entities. There are certain things that capture meaning, right? The issue with a lot of things, as the lot of the valuable stuff Armida Isaac were doing, was like certain verbs can contain a lot of information about power. So one thing is we want to also try and create contexts that clearly demonstrate a power imbalance or a lack of, but use realistic but less a singularly overloaded term. So a national army surrounds a separatist militia. Surrounds is not necessarily the same thing as bordered, dismissed. Water can surround an island. Same thing. Intentionally relay evacuation procedure. Here the power is not a single verb, right? So we're trying to capture a lot of linguistic variants too. So the whole point with this expansion is that for next week or later on, we're trying to create something we can use a system create a systematic profile.
How many different types of power again did you say that?
So I think we're at I removed the
24.
yeah it's 200 from it's about 220 different contexts, and I removed a couple supposed to be attribute conditions, but we're going to take 11 bias conditions. So it's going to be, and that's for positive power, there being no power. We want to actually open this up a bit, because while we're talking about isolating for verbs, there's a rough, I mean, I'm still going to do some quality control things, but the rough draft of this data set, at least in the first instance, is close to ready. But while we're talking about different conditions to isolate for, one thing that Armida brought up was, are there different formulations of power by which we can ask the prompt, right? Because if we're saying, is power being exercised, Armida, I believe you had a couple of other formulations we can ask the question, right? Because if we're asking the question the same way maybe we're trying to generate the data, that's not correct. There might be different Armida, she identified several different ways we can rephrase the question. So we're trying, I think the next step is going to try and be do a systematic scan, and then we're probably going to try and hone in a couple things. But as we expand the data set, we're actually hoping to ask some questions about what might be some interesting dimensions to interact with the data set.
Yeah. So my feedback. So I so for this and some of the other projects, right? I do think that people ask what one of the questions was, is probing second best, whatever, right? Once you develop a data set that has a pretty clear idea of what the concept is that data set's trying to encode, then probing is just a really natural thing to do. I mean, so it's a classification data set, and you can go around all the hidden states of your model, or ones that you think are you could train probes on them. And so I think that the causal, so like you've got these two different types of experiments, and you can go back and you can think about like what Sam Marks did in using these two things together. Well, so he didn't do probing, he did mass mean things, but he had a very simple binary class, is it true or not? And now you have like a, I don't know, maybe it's a 3,000-way classifier or something, I'm not really sure, right? So but he did it in two stages. First he says, well, I could probe anything, but really I'd rather probe the places in the model where I think is where it's really paying attention to this concept. And like what the previous work is found is often at the end of the sentence or something like this, but you could do a causal analysis just to highlight that these are the promising places to probe, and then you could train probes, right, to see what accuracies they get at different locations, and then once you have those probes, then there's other things you can do. You can do more causal so the probes will tell you what one of these classes, at least a probe thinks the model is thinking about. You can see if the probe agrees with your prompting strategy. You put a thing after that sentence and you say, what kind of power was it?
see if they agree or not.
And you know, a natural thing to do would be, is that really what it's looking at to make that assessment? Let's say the pros and the prompt agree.
You could go and force in a different representation into the probe and see
if that gets the prompt to behave a little differently. You know, that would be, I feel like that's sort of a way of bringing these things together and connecting it to like an internal thought. I think eventually you're going to have this question of like, so what do we care about what the model's thinking inside as opposed to what it's saying? Right? Are there situations like, so, you know, if you could just ask a model what it's thinking, then why do you need to, you know, why do you need to probe around on the inside? And so I think that, you know, so these are my suggestions on like things that you can do. These are just like mechanics, things you can do to try to pin down the thing. But I think that you also have a larger question of, it's like, okay, so let's say this all works and we can probe it out. We have causal effects and we know where the concept of power is. You know, what do we, you know, what do we get out of that? Like, why do we care? I can imagine there's a couple sorts of things that you could get out. But do you guys have a sense for why you want to look inside the model at power?
So our, like, going back to our original research that we started about, one thing was we wanted to try to identify at least certain triggers in the model, or at the very least if it was possible, then, you know, if there were certain noise or signals you could introduce.
Like look at the words that cause this inference.
Yeah, or even in particular in certain models, for instance, if it was possible to affect the signal in some predictable way, to have it reduce, to have it, you know, change its decision making. Or,
yeah.
Oh, that, I really like that, because, like, I'm in this, like, prompting group, and they're like, oh, like, if you don't capitalize things, or you have a typo, like, it gives you much worse results, and, like, stuff like that, or if you slang, like, and it feels like what your question is, like, asking, like, well, why does that happen? Like, was there some circuitry in there that's, like, making that judge? I feel like that'd be really cool to know, like, if the model is treating me differently because of some inference like that, like, maybe I only type in lowercase or something.
Interesting. I think one thing I should do, like, for some of these is, I think what could be interesting is, for instance, maybe I'm wrong, so for some of these examples, right, we've extracted, like, entities and verbs. If we do that and then use those as labels, it might be interesting if there's an experiment we can do, for instance, where we can reliably have it reverse decisions it makes based on patching things from different prompts in a controlled way. I don't know, though. That'd be...
Yeah, just to build off that a little bit, like, I think another way of thinking about this is, like, it's not just about power, but it's about, like, how models think about social relations more generally, and this is a very kind of particular conception of social relations, but maybe there's this, like, is a kind of template for thinking about other types of social relations as well, so there might be a little bit more of an intrinsic interest there.
I like that a lot. You're taking a very broad view right now, which is like, it leads to this thing like, okay, we're going to catalog all the problems, we're going to get 224 things, and that would just lead to this actual thing of a 224-way classifier that you just go and you say, and then like the natural experiment would be like, well, if we said have some piece of text that has to do with making ice cream, I wonder if you zap that classifier at it, if it says, oh, actually this ice cream paragraph is secretly about like nuclear weapons. Especially with something like that, right? You're like, that's really what the model is thinking about. So I think that that's kind of the direction that this data set would lead to. But there is this opposite direction, right? Which is really narrowing it, right? To say, hey, if you just have sentences with two people, like your other data set, and there's a relationship between them, like, how is that social relationship represented by the model?
To clarify, this is a binary classifier. We're just changing the different conditions. It's
always binary, yeah. But you have like 224 ways. It's like, you sure. know, like situations,
yeah.
Where so you could actually do the other thing too. You could also make a 224 way classifier on
on this large data if you wanted to. It's just the same data. You could just label it in another way. And it's actually a natural question. Like when you ask, how do models think about power? And this, you've asked this several times when you present. It's like, wow, you're preparing this data that you could use as a probe to see if any of these, you know, works better or, you know, is misclassified or does it have different, has it similar accuracy over all these classes or does it have higher accuracy on some of them or not? But yeah.
Athena class that you mentioned as well.
Yes.
Even like, let's say there's an interesting interaction, but it's reliably in one sector. That's still, you said, that's still something, as you said, right?
What do you mean?
I believe you said, if it's so, for instance, let's say the models are not interesting results for all but one category of the data, but it's reliably interesting in one or two areas of it.
Oh yeah, then that can still be interesting. Yeah, absolutely. Right. If you're like, oh, the model is like, have a very clear representation of most of these things, at least when we're probing this way, but the representation is clear this way. I think that's really interesting. At least given the state of the art today where we don't know anything about how the models work inside, just even partial insights. Pretty interesting. So.
I think the sentences that are unrelated, random, the model says there is power relation with
I've always been fascinated by that. I think this is so. When I showed you the paper from Yida Chen, Wattenberg's group, where they're like, "Hey, here's like a bunch of probes for are you rich or poor? Are you educated or you're not? Are you are you male or female?" The fun thing about that is that you can just put in other random sentences. You can say, I was reading the Wall Street Journal the other day. It says, "Oh, you're definitely male," or something like that, right? Like, well, that's a bias, right? You know what I mean? And so I think that's kind of interesting. If you have a classifier like this, it now gives you another tool that you can do now. But now, of course, the other it's not a full paper by itself. It's just a tool because it leads. Because if you tried to make a full paper out of it, people would just say, "Well, why don't you just go to the language model and just ask it? Do you think I'm a boy or a girl? Or do you think this is part of religion? You're just like the way that you're doing." And then if it tells you that, why don't you trust it? Right. So there's a couple situations. You could be a situation where, well, for some reason you don't want to trust the model because you think it's lying to you. Or it could be a situation where, oh, the point is not to just read the signal out, but to see where the signal's coming from, or something like that, right? Or the point could be you have 200 different types of signals, and you're trying to tell which ones are more faithfully represented in the model, and which ones are not, as your proposal for the models know about this, and they don't, and you can see evidence that they know about it from the way they represent, or something like that. Like there's a few different takes that you could. Take on like why you want to look inside, but so you're getting there, right? You're looking around at enough things now that maybe you should have a stronger opinion, right? About which one of the questions to ask, right? Anyway, that's my comment. But I think that it looks good. Yep. Any other suggestions? All right. Always like. Suggestions.
I think it's also like having so currently it's kind of a static situation where there's one like so basically the subject, verb, and object. So you have the subject is asserting power over the object. If I'm not.
You mean in that form,
right?
I think most of them are like that. Yeah.
So like, can you make this into a dynamic situation where, say, over a number of turns, it's modulating. So does the model assign power just to, say, Alice, or in the case of Alice and Bob, does it always assign power to Alice irrespective of the situation or irrespective of the turn?
We did mess around with that, didn't we? Where we were switching the subject and the object, and then in terms of we were asking who had power, we were doing the patching. Didn't we do an experiment like that?
Yeah, I don't think we had it like evolve over time, though.
It was,
yeah.
The turn the tables kind of thing.
Yeah,
it's a good movie plot.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, it'd be like having a
sequence, then ask at this point who has power in the situation. Sequence runs a little bit longer. Who has power at this point? Yeah.
So, because I don't know if this was helpful. There's a paper. I don't even know if it's a paper, but I saw a presentation by this person, and they basically gave two country names, and they ask, like, if you had to save someone from this country, or would you save someone from this country? And they swapped the country, like, they didn't, like, keep it always. For example, it's, would you save an Indian or would you save an American? And surprisingly, it always saved, like, the global south than the global north. So that was, but they also, like, switched up stuff, so then that could be, the model always stuck true to the identity.
How would you end that?
We're done.
Yeah.
Okay, we're done. So how? So we can go through about half of the teams. Should we do that pace? Do you want to do half the teams 1 week and half the teams the other week, or do you want to just do every team every week? Like, how do you guys feel about that?
I think it would be better for one team. We can do it twice a month. Because if you're doing it per week,
do you want to scale back to that? Like, what do you guys think? I don't know.
Yeah, it often feels like there isn't.
I think it might be good especially since we're getting, I think a lot of us are moving towards.
You're getting more into it. You're not just like proposing, oh, I don't know what we're doing. You're doing stuff, right? So why don't we do that? So there's a few teams that, so I didn't write down. Nikhil, can I ask you to write down which teams presented this week? So which team presented?
The first three,
which was
TK,
economics,
TK, economics,
and power. Okay. And we had bias yesterday. So like bias is like half, okay? Yeah, and so why don't we do this instead of having you guys present on Tuesday, the next three groups just present on Thursday next week. Does that make sense? And then we'll go into this, and we can be a little flexible if somebody wants to do an extra presentation. Okay.
Do remember to sign up for that. If you get any issues, please let me know.
Try to parse out some of it, and also ask for like cipher wise.
Because like I think one of the things that
players
that I think is the test of thinking.
We can avoid the predicate prompts.
Yeah.
So it's like let's say a prompt is like one of our sentences, right?
You access wait.
You have a predicate.
What? Let me get that taken care of. Also, do you need keys or anything? I have like open router.
Oh, yeah,
so
I need to think about it.
Okay,
yeah, I don't want
to. Oh my gosh, yeah, I'm so sorry.
I think it's fine. It's power, it's classification accuracy, it's really
thanks for doing all the to like set up the meetings and
so
everything.
Like,
I don't know if there are different conditions.
Because at that point, when we found something, I think.